Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. We continue airing highlights from our December Get Lit with All of It book club event. We spent the month reading Jonathan Lethem's 1999 detective novel, Motherless Brooklyn, which we selected from the New York Public Library's list of 125 NYC books we love. As always, you had a lot of great questions and observations for our author. The first question came from Katie Stanford, who asked about the audiobook of Motherless Brooklyn, a particular challenge for any voice actor considering the vocal tics exhibited throughout the novel by the protagonist, Lionel, who has Tourette's syndrome. Katie wanted to know, did Jonathan have any say over who would record the audiobook? And his answer involves a famous actor.
This is a funny thing about this particular book. There exist two audiobooks of Motherless Brooklyn. And the first one was done by the actor Steve Buscemi. And
wow,
that
I
sounds
like that.
Marvelous. And it was marvelous. But it also was a strange thing that is very rare nowadays, which is the world of audiobooks was still not as confident a one as it's become. And it was abridged. And they lopped out about 25% of the language to make it move more quickly. So there's this wonderful Buscemi performance on this, for me, slightly regrettable abridgment of the novel. But that's out there somewhere. I'm forgetting the name of the one that's more likely the one you refer to, which is complete. It's the whole text. And it is also extraordinary. I as I recall, I was given, and this is typically the case for me, and I think a lot of authors might have the same experience. I was given a kind of a menu of three or four voices and asked for an opinion on which person, which actor or voice performer ought to do it. They're always so incredibly good. I mean, any of these people who make it their living to do audiobooks, their capacities are extraordinary. And having done a couple of audiobooks myself and sat at the mic and tried to make something come alive, and I know mine are not as good as these voice performers' results, and so I know what a thing it is to do it right. So I'm glad you liked it.
Ayaka says, I haven't seen the movie, but I understand it's very different time setting, plot, characters. How do you feel about that as an author?
So this is another good story. I met Edward Norton when he first optioned the book, which was now over 20 years ago, because it happened. Not, the book wasn't even published. It was circulating in galleys, and he became interested in it and caused a movie company called New Line to acquire the rights so that he could work with it. And we had a conversation almost immediately. He remarkably had a vision from the very beginning, which was he wanted to bring the material of traditional film noir, the 1950s, the detective milieu that was more characteristic of the kind of books that I'd grown up emulating when I wrote this book, and take it out of the present day and move it into the past. And he also wanted to do what he did do, which is introduce elements of gentrification and urban renewal and race into the story that weren't really anything but kind of just lurking. They were implications maybe around the edges of this story. I thought this was all really thrilling, and I liked it on principle too, because I usually like movies that are really different from the books that give them their source. To me, the history of people trying to make very, very faithful adaptations tends to lead to kind of stilted and uncinematic films. And I usually like it better when a director just grabs onto some elements, some images, some set pieces, and makes something completely new.
Donna said, I lived in Red Hook from 1978, so it was great to hear all the streets I knew before they were gentrified. And I was thinking about that. I remember for a while the real estate industry tried to call that area Bococa, Borum
Bococa.
Hill.
There was even a Bococa Cafe.
Bococa. when was the last time you strolled around that area? And what do you think about when you were in this gentrified part of Brooklyn now?
You know, so it in the last reply, I alluded to the way the film introduces thoughts about gentrification and race and urban renewal and the kind of deeper urban subjects. Those are also ones that preoccupy me. And the book I wrote immediately following Motherless Brooklyn was a book called The Fortress of Solitude, where I, instead of writing a Valentine and a kind of a fantasy about this place, I tried to dig into some of the extremely complex legacy of my own experience of growing up in what was Gowanus and became Borum Hill, because I was very much an intimate witness to the early definition that became the target of such a gigantic, and I mean, it's an overwhelming gentrification now. It's been taken and made into a kind of a playground neighborhood where movie stars live. Well, you know, when I was first a kid in that, on that turf, we had as many bricked up windows and abandoned houses as we did well-renovated ones. And we had rooming houses on Dean Street. And it was a very, very, I guess I'd say, deeply mongrel neighborhood. It didn't even have a traditional name. It was South Brooklyn, or maybe it was North Gowanus, or it was just where you were when you were not yet in Park Slope or Brooklyn Heights. And seeing what's become of it is something that's so strange and intense for me that I couldn't answer your question easily. I had to write a very long autobiographical novel to begin to say how mixed up I was and how moved I was by all of the contradictions that emerged from that experience.
This is sort of broad, but I think interesting. Louise on Instagram asks, how did you create such different settings? They make the book great. From the Zendo Eastern philosophy experience to the backseat of a car where someone's going to their certain death, to the intimate spaces with Kimmery and Lionel.
That's great. I like that a lot. I mean, I think about settings all the time. And of course, this book had a sort of a home ground, right? It was the streets of the neighborhood. And it also had a house style, if you will, or a room tone. Because in the neighborhood, people talk, and they talk urgently, and they talk a lot, and they make sarcastic jokes. And Lionel had Tourette's, and people were full of insults and banter, and there was a lot of aggression. So what I did, and you know, this is something I might not have been able to enunciate at the time, but I can see it clearly in retrospect, I looked for contrast. If New York and the babble of voices were going to predominate in this story, then I was going to want to contrast those with their total opposites. So by looking for Zen Buddhism and moving the story into a Zen monastery where people are trying to have a collective silent meditation, it was a way of exemplifying and also making very funny the difference between the two. And I think I reached for that again when I moved the story to the woods, to Maine. You know, I mean, one of the things growing up as a New York, basically a street kid, you only know the canyon of the streets. You know, I mean, you might have a scrap, you might go to Prospect Park, but you're never out of sight of rooftops. And there can be a kind of terror of the open sky. You know, I knew a story about a kid when I was growing up whose parents took him on the F train to Coney Island. And when he got out under the sky on the beach, he started weeping in terror because he wasn't enclosed enough. And so Lionel is a product of this kind of, you know, he really doesn't, his body doesn't know what it's like to be out of that space. So I wanted to thrust him by putting him into coastal Maine and putting him out on that lighthouse and, you know, among those evergreen trees. I wanted to, again, seek the contrast that would exemplify this idea about who he was.
So, dear sweet Lionel, we talked about what a sweetheart he was at the beginning, how much we want to root for him and how people feel warm about him. He ultimately, at the end, takes his revenge. And he does not opt for mercy for the person who is responsible for Minna's death. Why not?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that in some ways I was invested in the imperatives of the crime story. I thought I'd had my liberties with it, but that there ought to be, you know, a pursuit of justice. And in this case, you know, revenge isn't inapt. There's that aspect to it too. But I also felt that this was a story about someone who was trying to become a detective and become autonomous and express his devotion to Frank Minna. And so all of those things drove that result.
Those were a few highlights from the Q&A portion of our Get Lit with All of It book club event with author Jonathan Lethem. We spent the month reading his novel, Motherless Brooklyn.